Anne Lamott's Hallelujah Anyway has become something of a spiritual lifeline for those navigating life's turbulent waters. Oprah Winfrey called it a book that will change your perspective on life's challenges, while Brené Brown credits it with helping shape her understanding of vulnerability. Since its publication, this Meditation on Mercy has sold over 1 million copies and been translated into 26 languages. What makes this slim volume so powerful? Perhaps it's Lamott's uncanny ability to articulate our deepest struggles with self-forgiveness and compassion while making us laugh out loud. Her work speaks to that universal human condition. We know we should be kinder to others and ourselves, yet we find it impossibly difficult. Through her signature blend of wit, raw honesty, and spiritual insight, Lamott invites us to rediscover mercy as our birthright, something we've always possessed but forgotten how to access. We enter this world as mercy machines, open, vulnerable, and naturally compassionate. As children, we instinctively comfort others in pain and freely offer forgiveness, reaching out to wipe away tears or share a beloved toy without hesitation. Watch any toddler encounter someone crying, and you'll witness this innate compassion in action. They'll often toddle over, pat the person's knee, or offer their own stuffed animal as comfort. But somewhere along the way, life teaches us to armor up. We learn that an open heart invites pain, that vulnerability makes us look foolish, and that forgiveness might be mistaken for weakness. Through disappointments, betrayals, and the harsh realities of the world, we retreat behind walls of judgment, resentment, and self-protection. Lamott turns to the prophet Micah's ancient guidance: do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with thy God. While justice and humility present their own challenges, mercy, simple kindness and compassion, should be the easiest part. Yet for many of us, it remains the most elusive. Why? Because trauma and fear block our access to this fundamental aspect of our nature. Each slight, each betrayal, each disappointment adds another brick to the wall we build around our hearts, until showing mercy feels like scaling a fortress. What if mercy isn't something we need to acquire, but something we need to uncover? What if forgiveness, even of the seemingly unforgivable, is already within us? This is Lamott's radical proposition. She confesses her own struggle to extend mercy, especially to herself and annoying relatives. We all have them. Her honesty is disarming. I love being right. It's mood-altering and covers my sins. She describes catching herself in petty judgments, holding on to grievances like precious jewels, and the exhausting work of maintaining righteousness. There's something profoundly liberating in this admission. How many of us choose righteous indignation over compassion? How often do we prefer the storm of drama, where we can play the hero, to the quiet work of forgiveness? We rehearse our grievances, polish our grudges, and wear our wounds like badges of honor. Yet when we flash even a moment of mercy towards someone we dislike, something shifts. We experience what Lamott calls a spiritual moment that reconnects us with our essential nature. It might be as simple as choosing not to share gossip, letting someone merge in traffic, or holding space for a difficult person's pain. Think about the last time you let go of a grudge. Remember that lightness, that sudden expansion in your chest? That's not coincidence. It's reconnection with your true self. As an African Christian catechism beautifully puts it, God created us because he thought we would like it. Despite everything, puberty, warfare, heartbreak, political divisions, environmental crises, there remains love, singing, nature, laughter, and mercy. The mercy we were born with still lives within us, waiting to be remembered and released. Even in our most armored moments, that original tenderness persists. Hallelujah, anyway. Remember adolescence, that excruciating time when everyone saw your insecurities while you saw theirs? Life in what Lamott calls the shrapnel field. We armored ourselves with fashion, makeup, achievement, and irony, having lost contact with our innately merciful selves. Self-respect seemed as distant as adulthood. Yet even in those difficult years, mercy found us. It appeared in friendships that saved us and in teachers who understood life's beauty and difficulty. Frederick Buchner suggests that perhaps a teacher's main job is to teach gently the inevitability of pain. Those mentors who acknowledged our struggles while helping us navigate them were practicing a profound form of mercy. College offered what Lamont describes as a buffet of new experiences beyond the mac and cheese of home. We believed we'd outgrown our awkward adolescent selves, only to discover that college operated on the same competitive principles where half would fail. Our expectations were continually dashed as we realized we were just cogs in a larger machine. Then came adulthood, with its jobs that rarely matched our talents, relationships that revealed our partners to be strange, cranky people, and children who brought both miraculous love and bone-deep exhaustion. Through it all, friendship remained our sustenance, taking us hiking, dancing, to protests, providing ground for meaning against our persistent belief we were frauds. And finally, old age arrives, when almost everything fails: vision, hearing, memory, random organs. Aging is relentlessly hard, yet the only thing that truly helps is deep connection with a few people. Lamont shares a powerful story about her son confronting her after she made a snarky public comment about a transgender person. "I love you, but you were wrong," he told her, refusing to let it go or let her go. His mercy became a protective cloak that helped her breathe again. Isn't this the truest form of love? Not blind acceptance, but the willingness to hold someone accountable while refusing to abandon them. When have you experienced this kind of mercy? The kind that sees your failings clearly, yet embraces you anyway. The path away from judgment requires major mercy, both giving and receiving it. Without mercy, we fall into fundamentalism and blame. The way out begins with three simple words: I was wrong. As Lewis Smeds wrote, to forgive is to set a prisoner free and discover that the prisoner was you. Mercy emerges most powerfully from broken hearts. In Malawi, Lamont tells us, men stand back unto death so women and children can have scarce medications. This requires abandoning the pretense of being unscarred and self-sufficient. Here, Lamont introduces us to the ancient Chinese practice of kintsugi, embellishing cracks in pottery with gold leaf. Rather than hiding damage, this art form honors it, valuing something enough to repair it. The gold leaf becomes part of the object's beauty, showing restoration beyond baseline. What a powerful metaphor for human brokenness. What if our scars and failures aren't shameful flaws to conceal, but potential sites of transformation? What if our broken places, when filled with the gold of mercy and compassion, become our most beautiful features? The word misericordia, Latin for mercy, derives from heart and pity. It's not something you do, but something in you, cultivated through use. The Good Samaritan parable illustrates this perfectly: mercy shown not by religious authorities, but by a despised outsider. When a Jewish man was beaten and left in a ditch, a priest and Levite passed by, but a Samaritan stopped, moved by pity. He cared for the man and took him to safety. Lamont shares modern mercy stories that take my breath away: relatives forgiving the Charleston church shooter, a South African woman adopting her family's murderer, Tibetan nuns praying for their torturers, Amish including a killer's widow in their mourning circle. In recovery communities, mercy manifests when the broken help the broken, as when newly sober alcoholics care for a man who has soiled himself, treating him with dignity and kinship. These stories challenge us. Could I forgive such transgressions? Could you? Yet they also remind us that mercy isn't about feeling, it's about action. It's showing up. It's binding wounds. It's creating community through singing or sharing holy silence. In unfolding ourselves to others, we are enfolded together, creating a melding of spirits amid ordinary moments. Maps transform lives by returning us to dreams, childhood, poetry, and reality. They move us toward unknown destinations, help us navigate difficult periods, and give directions home. Like well-worn paths in ancient forests, they guide us through life's complexities with their familiar lines and symbols. A friend told Lamont that the point of life isn't staying alive, but staying in love. Maps offer this possibility by taking us to new places, old favorites, and back home. Unlike the quick escapes of drugs or shopping, love, maps, nature, and books transport us out of time in a way that nourishes rather than depletes, offering sustainable solace rather than fleeting relief. Lamott shares two contrasting journeys, one to an upscale bohemian store called Zoology after a terrible argument with her son, and another to Hiroshima with her Jesuit friend Tom. In Zoology, surrounded by beautiful objects promising transformation, delicate silk scarves, handcrafted jewelry, artisanal ceramics, she confronted existential dread about her son's anger. The store's carefully curated atmosphere, with its soft lighting and aromatic candles, seemed to mock her inner turmoil. Despite the store's enchantment, the golden antique map gleaming on the wall, the perfect lilac cardigan soft against her skin, she couldn't escape her rock-bottom feelings. Only calling a friend provided real mercy, along with a sales girl's simple kindness in bringing her water, noticing her distress beneath the facade of casual shopping. Haven't we all sought comfort in consumption, only to discover its emptiness? The new outfit that promises to make us feel confident, the latest gadget that claims to simplify our lives, the home decorations that suggest domestic bliss. They promise transformation, but deliver only momentary distraction. True mercy comes through connection, through the simple kindness of being seen in our pain, through the gentle acknowledgement of our humanity by another person who recognizes our struggle. In Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park, Lamott witnessed something extraordinary: Hawaiian folk singers performing for Japanese audiences, the first Americans attacked by Japan singing to the first people America nuclear bombed. Their voices carried traditional songs across the carefully tended gardens, past the paper cranes and memorial stones. This unexpected harmony transcended violent history, offering a glimpse of mercy's transformative power. The music became a bridge across decades of pain, demonstrating how art and human connection can heal even the deepest wounds. Later, reading a bombing survivor's poem about tomatoes and a dying sister, she discovered mercy in these smallest moments of connection across profound divides. In the way simple details of daily life, a ripening tomato, a sister's last breath, could carry universal truth. This is mercy's paradox. It appears most powerfully in the aftermath of great suffering, like flowers pushing through cracks in concrete. The Hawaiian singers and Japanese audience created something beautiful from historical trauma, transforming old enmities into shared humanity. The survivor's poem transformed unbearable loss into art that could be shared across cultures and generations, speaking to universal experiences of love and loss. What wounds might you transform through mercy? What maps might lead you home to your compassionate self? Perhaps the journey begins with recognizing that our personal maps, marked with both triumphs and failures, guide us toward deeper understanding of ourselves and others. Being alive is a mixed grill, lovely, hard, and confusing. Good and bad things happen to everyone in this chaotic world, often simultaneously and without warning. Yet mercy appears even in our fear and suffering, like unexpected light filtering through storm clouds. The challenge lies not in avoiding suffering, but in finding meaning within it. Where is mercy in childhood cancer, earthquakes, addiction, or suicide? These profound questions echo through human experience. In Christian tradition, Christ continues to be crucified in all suffering, and we must respond, not with answers, but with presence. We show up for real, annoying people with their messy lives and complicated needs. The rabbinical tradition reminds us we're only on the sixth day, not done yet, and neither is God. This perspective offers both humility and hope, suggesting that creation itself remains unfinished. When tragedy strikes, death, illness, despair, the miracle is in our imperfect collective response. We show up, often awkwardly, not knowing what to say. We bring sandwiches, casseroles, and coffee. We offer presence and the willingness to feel awful together, sitting in uncomfortable chairs in hospital waiting rooms or around kitchen tables laden with untouched food. This is mercy, not running away when disappointed, but staying even when our presence feels inadequate. Lamotte shares the story of her friend Anne, whose son died by suicide. Anne experienced both devastating grief and unexpected moments of peace, the kind that descends like gentle rain after a storm. In her garden memorial, surrounded by impatience that reflect moonlight and darkness, they held and released him together. These gatherings serve multiple purposes: to cry, to remember, to hold on, and ultimately to free ourselves from grinding regret. The community forms a living circle of witness and support. The impatience in Anne's garden offer a powerful symbol: flowers that reflect light even in darkness, blooming persistently through difficult conditions. Mercy works similarly, providing glimmers of comfort in our darkest moments. It doesn't erase pain or make everything okay, but it creates space for both grief and healing to coexist. Like these resilient flowers, mercy finds ways to shine even in shadow. Think about a time when someone showed up for you in suffering, not to fix it or offer platitudes, but simply to be present. Perhaps they brought coffee every morning, or sat silently while you cried, or remembered your loved one's birthday after everyone else had moved on. That's mercy in action. Or remember when you've done this for someone else, stayed longer than comfortable, listened to the same story again, held space for rage and despair. In those moments, we transcend our separate selves and touch something deeper, something that connects us all in our shared humanity. Through these acts of mercy, we create a web of connection that sustains us through darkness. We become living proof that while suffering is inevitable, we need not face it alone. This shared vulnerability and presence becomes its own kind of light, illuminating paths through what seems unbearable.
My 6-year-old grandson calls to me as he drifts to sleep. That was the best day ever. Then wakes terrified in darkness, crying, "Nana, will you ever get sick or die?" He's like a pond, self-contained, teeming with life, but also hidden dangers. When morning comes, he awakens saying, "This could be the best day ever. He can fly again." We were all somehow held and cared for enough to exist. The universe gave us sunlight, water, milk, yet we were taught the opposite of the rule of love. Anything leaving us more fearful, isolated, or disconnected is not of God. Sometimes we drop into another plane, to that trusting spirit, knowing we're held underneath all things. Then we snap back to life's video game. Beneath everything lies something indestructible, a foundation we need when all seems lost. Lamotte shares the story of a Senegalese village facing water crisis, yet greeting activist Lynn Twist with drums and dancing despite their desperation. The women had visions of an underground lake, and though the men initially refused to let them dig, eventually they persisted for over a year until finding water exactly as they'd seen. This is mercy baobab trees, giving shade, new water from an ancient lake, men releasing rigid roles, helpers arriving with second winds. Deep calls to deep, soul reaches to soul. Pope Francis says God's name is mercy. It's our unclaimed self in the lost and found drawer, startling us awake when we hear it. The underground lake serves as a perfect metaphor for mercy. It's always there, sustaining life, even when we can't see it. The women's persistence, their refusal to accept defeat, their vision of abundance in the face of scarcity, this is mercy in action. And when the men eventually joined them, taking on some women's chores while they dug, traditional roles dissolved in service of community survival. Have you ever experienced this kind of transcendence in ordinary moments? The dairy aisle, people making eye contact, letting others go first? Even a moment's transcendence changes everything. It reminds us that beneath our separate identities and daily struggles flows a common source that nourishes us all. What medicine heals our own awfulness? Evidence exists in that salty energy causing holy thirst to heal, to help, to extend ourselves. After harsh words with friends, reconciliation seems impossible, yet it happens. Sobriety comes not in a single dose, but bit by bit over time. Something works within us, mending cuts with atomic knitting needles, patching rifts in damaged families and dented hearts, transforming us from clenched and shut down to taking fresh gulps of air like newborns. Julian of Norwich wrote that all will be well in the fullness of time, but what about now? What about Africa, depressed teenagers, our planet? Transformation hurts. As Krishnamurti said, I don't mind what happens, a state Lamotte desperately wants but resists. Paul of Tarsus understood our struggle with darkness. What I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. He preached acceptance as we are, thorns and all. Our secrets feel vile, but something quirky and ephemeral can restore us. We move forward incrementally, softening ever so slightly with minimal willingness, and as Machado wrote, anyone who moves forward, even a little, is like Jesus walking on the water. This is perhaps the hardest mercy, extending forgiveness to ourselves. We judge our own failings more harshly than anyone else's. We believe our darkest thoughts define us. We imagine our mistakes are unforgivable. Yet self-forgiveness isn't about excusing bad behavior or avoiding responsibility. It's about acknowledging our humanity and moving forward with greater awareness. Have you ever noticed how much easier it is to forgive others than yourself? How you can understand contextual factors and extenuating circumstances when friends make mistakes, yet hold yourself to impossible standards? What if you extended to yourself the same compassion you offer others? Lamotte suggests that transformation happens not in dramatic moments, but in small increments, softening ever so slightly, taking one tiny step forward. This is how healing works, not all at once, but bit by bit over time. And each small step matters enormously. There are multiple paths to mercy in this harsh world. Two reliable routes to self-forgiveness exist. Terminal illness, which focuses people on joy and forgiveness, or finding a teacher who guides us beyond our small thinking. 30 years ago, 1 week after her last drink, Lamotte met Loretta, a former junkie and cranky gardener with watchful, kind eyes. Lamotte was tense, judgmental, and considering just one beer after 7 sober days. Loretta listened to her story. 32, published, loved by family and friends, yet drunk daily. She was poor and bulimic, but adorable and cherished, with one problem, her insides. The elevator only went down. Her mind deteriorated faster than she could lower her standards. Loretta shared her story of orphanage, addiction, and recovery. She offered what Lamotte needed, a way to take each day as it came with humor and gratitude. She taught her to stay sober, pray for those she couldn't forgive, and that life wasn't black and white. They were mostly okay, like a dog named Mostly who occasionally bit. Years later, in a beautiful twist of mercy, Loretta became Lamotte's Alzheimer's-afflicted mother's nurse. They fell in love, giving her lonely mother companionship in her final years. Sometimes mercy appears in unexpected forms, like tadpoles for a depressed teenage friend of Lamotte's. After weeks of sleeping and reading graphic novels, this young woman discovered an empty aquarium in her garage. She filled it with pond water and tadpoles, watching them thrive in their natural environment. When she made a mistake, adding too much spinach that fouled the water, she didn't take it as proof of her defectiveness, but instead found solutions. As the tadpoles grew legs and transformed into tiny frogs, she returned them to the pond with careful attention to their safety. Through this simple act of care, the bright, eccentric, curious child in her reemerged. The tadpoles in murky water became a clear channel back to herself, a tiny future she could work with again. Mercy creates futures for the downtrodden. The Book of Ruth shows how Ruth's loyalty to her mother-in-law Naomi led her to become a gleaner in the fields, gathering leftover grain. The landowner Boaz instructed workers to leave extra grain behind, a model more merciful than trickle-down economics. Just don't take it all. Always leave some behind. From this came goodness. Boaz married Ruth, and they became King David's great-grandparents. Through mercy, we outshine resentment and rediscover the person who marvels at tadpoles, who pulls for second chances. Mercy is there for the asking, like yeast that transforms ordinary flour into bread, changing us from within at the channel between the lagoon and the sea.